This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of the World Wide Wave on joy.org.au.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community. This is the World Wide Wave.
This is World Wide Wave, Joy's international news and current affairs show. We take you around the globe, one country at a time. In the studio tonight, I'm joined by Paul.
Hello.
Hello, Damien.
Hi.
And myself, Matt. Germany's history has not always been kind to the gay community, but there was a time when Berlin was the gay centre of the world. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, Berlin not only had a decadent and very camp nightlife, but also attracted academics with new ideas on sexuality and gender.
How did this thirst for expanding the human knowledge through scientific thinking allow previously taboo subjects of sex and sexuality to be studied?
How did disproving same-sex desire lead to the coining of the term transsexual?
And how did Berlin in the 1920s set the scene for today's gay rights movement? To take us back almost 100 years, tonight we are speaking to Robert Beachy, author of a new book called Gay Berlin, Birthplace of a Modern Identity. Here's a taste of what we've got coming up tonight.
The kinds of policies that were developed by the Berlin police specifically. And fairly early on, already in the 1880s, they decided that as a pragmatic issue, it wasn't really a good idea to try to prevent different sorts of bars or cafes from appealing to or catering to what appeared to be a homosexual or in some cases a lesbian public. And so these kinds of establishments were actually allowed to operate fairly openly.
Worldwide Wrap, LGBT news from around the world, scanning the globe for stories for the diverse gay and lesbian communities from Australia's Joy 94.9. This is the Worldwide Wrap.
Kicking off in war-ravaged Ukraine, where the city of Lviv has had to abandon an LGBT festival after the venue was surrounded by about 200 members of a far-right group shouting, "Kill, kill, kill." The event on the theme of equality was the first of three regional events which occurred around Kiev, the first being held in December. It included things like film screenings, literary discussions and public events. But they had lots and lots of issues in planning the events, as neither the police or the local authorities for the city, which is a major tourist centre in Ukraine, would give their blessing to the festival.
In fact, a lot of the venues pulled out, saying that they would only allow the event to go on if the mayor, i.e. the authorities of the city, approved the event.
Indeed. And last Friday evening, in a late night hearing, a court decided that it was too dangerous for the events to run and banned the festival. Organisers said that dozens of far-right young people, some in masks, attended the court hearing with the intention of intimidating them.
Matters came to a head on Saturday when a far-right group surrounded the new hotel where about 70 participants were trying to gather for the festival. About 200 gathered outside, and even when the police were called, only one car arrived about an hour later.
Right, so they put a high priority on that one. This has attracted outrage from various parts of Europe.
Over in Uganda, you'd be surprised to hear, or maybe not, that Uganda has as many gays as the rest of the world.
They're not surprised. They're probably not out gays, but
I doubt it. No. There was a study conducted by one of the universities in Uganda. They looked at 300 students and asked them a number of questions.
3,000, in
3,000, sorry.
Big survey.
And they found that one in three of the respondents had been in love with a person of the same gender. 6 to 8% of the men and 10 to 16% of women had had sexual activity with someone of the same gender.
Wow, that actually surprises me that the women double the number of men.
Maybe it's just the percentage that admitted it.
Well, that's true. And in fact, that's one of the organisers actually made that comment, that they actually felt that the figures could have been higher because of the intense pressure and the propaganda against homosexuality in Uganda. Yeah, they've intimidated some people from being honest.
The organisers of the study suggest the links between same-sex attraction and mental health issues is a strong link between that.
And in fact, mental health issues are much higher. Of course, this is a president who's just been re-elected but tried to bring in the anti-homosexuality bill, which was struck down by the Constitutional Court, then brought in another law trying to ban NGOs, non-government organisations, from helping the country's LGBT population.
And it's still legal to be gay in Uganda.
Moving over to a more uplifting story out of India, a new grassroots campaign has been started to counter homophobia. This is from the place that had illegal homosexuality, legalised homosexuality, and then they turned it back. So
they are toing and froing.
They are toing and throwing. It's called 50 Shades of Gay. So
50 Shades of Gay. Yes, I like that.
For those that have been living under a rock bigger than the one that I live under, that is a play on words from the famous movie 50 Shades of Grey.
And book.
And book.
Serial. And
yep, it goes on.
And on and on.
This is a real grassroots campaign too. So they're using Instagram to try and share messages, personal stories, to try and break down this angst within the parliament of re-legalising same-sex relations.
Yeah, one of the organisers says that they believe that stories will be able to connect people, transform opinions, open minds and change policies.
Goes on to say that she's just trying to tell the story of 2.5 million Indians who are being treated as criminals and are being denied basic human rights in this country. I mean, wow. That's a statement.
The numbers are huge. Across to Botswana, where the highest court has ruled that the LGBT advocacy group Legabibo, who we have spoken to on this show and have had a very, very long-running fight to be able to be registered, the highest court has ruled that they can be. They have overturned the decision of the parliament and said that the group is legal, and it gives faith and hope to Botswana's legal system, the locals said.
A long fight. 11 years. That is a long fight.
Never, ever give in.
In brief, Moali, the Catholic bishop, has attacked the government for placing a moratorium on harmful homosexual laws.
Over to Malaysia, where a documentary on religious police attempting to clamp down on LGBTI Muslims in the country has sparked an online debate on the treatment they receive from the police.
In the Faroe Islands, which is a tiny country of about 48,000 people wedged between Norway and Iceland, the parliament has rejected same-sex marriage despite surveys showing public support at 75%.
Oh, wait, that sounds like... Oh, no. Carry on.
And in the US, for the first time ever, the White House LGBT liaison is a trans woman.
Woo-hoo.
And that's a wrap.
That's your Worldwide Wrap. Keep up with LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like us on Facebook, Worldwide Wave, or visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
At Joy 94.9, there are approximately 300 volunteers bringing you over 75 shows, 24 hours per day, 7 days a week. That's a lot of facts and figures to take in, but here's one more number for you to think about. 1-300-569-949. That's the number to call to talk to the Joy sales team about becoming a Joy sponsor. One phone call can get your business on air and online, reaching thousands of Joy listeners at a price you can afford. 1-300-JOY-949. That's 1-300-569-949.
Hi, I am Tim.
And I'm Ben.
From Hallam, Melbourne.
And you are listening to the Worldwide Wave
on Joy 94.9.
Message in from one of our regulars. Hey guys, I was in the audience of Q&A last night and was very proud to hear the young gay man and his passionate support for the Safe Schools program. A wonderful wake-up call to the wider community of nasty politicking. Very proud of Daniel Andrews and his articulate response towards the GLBTI community. I too was watching and I too was impressed, very impressed on both parts. So good on you.
Taking you around the globe, one country at a time. This is your Fun Fast Facts.
We are indeed in Germany tonight. We're going to take a bit of a look back to the hedonistic days of Germany in the late 1800s and early 1900s. The German gay rights movement began in 1896 when a small circle of gay male friends and associates began sporadic publication of a journal.
Would we call those allies now?
Perhaps. Well, we don't know how they were associating at that time.
True.
But De Egin, I think is the pronunciation. I probably got that wrong. It consisted of articles written by gay scholars, erotic photos and personal ads, which allowed gay German men to meet discreetly and network with one another. Of course, paragraph 175, which is the strict German penal code, made homosexual sex punishable by very stiff sentences.
There was obviously a struggle for gay rights in Germany, and it was taken up by the Scientific Humanitary Committee, which was founded in 1897. It was led by Magnus Hertzfeld, and the SHC, as it was known, had three goals. The removal of paragraph 175, educating the public about homosexuality, and forging interest among homosexuals in the gay rights movement.
That's not amazing, like 1897.
Not much changed, really.
They did gain the support of some prominent Germans, both gay and straight, but Hirschfeld and other members were ultimately unsuccessful in their attempts to win a repeal of those anti-gay laws. Work of the group was not in vain, though, as homosexuality became a widespread topic of conversation and debate.
It was discussed by the leading German newspapers and in the leading households around the country. German men emerged from the shadows to make their presence known to their straight countrymen.
Interestingly, the devastation of the First World War and the loss caused many German people to re-examine their national values, including their sexual values. So the 1920s, a greater sense of tolerance emerged than was previously there, and that led to many gay people actually coming out of the closet.
So what? What was the thought there? They thought, oh, geez, war's pretty crap, so all this other stuff doesn't really matter.
Well, I think there was probably also a sense of needing some positivity in the society that had such a crushing defeat and various war reparations and things like that.
And so, let's face it, we know how to throw a party.
We know how to party. Yeah.
Gay bars and clubs opened in major German cities, creating a coherent gay neighbourhoods. Historian Frank Richter estimate there were more gay bars and publications in 1920 Berlin, in the capital of Germany, as it was then, than in 1980 New York.
Fantastic. Of course, that all came to a crushing halt with the rise of Hitler and the Nazi regime.
Joy 94.9.
Prior to the rise of Hitler and Nazi Germany, Berlin was perhaps the gayest place in the world. Gay life in Berlin under the Weimar Republic was a great time. Gay journals and periodicals were sold openly on the streets. Gay bars flourished with little crackdown from police, and leading academics began to talk scientifically about homosexuality. Robert Beachy, an academic expert in German history, has written a new book titled Gay Berlin, Birthplace of a Modern Identity. We asked Robert to describe for us the gay scene in the late 1800s and early 1900s in Berlin.
I think probably most people have the impression, if they know something about the period at all, that Germany would have been a pretty repressive and conservative place. And I think that's, you know, accurate to a certain extent, but there was also a great deal going on, you could say, just below the surface. Berlin especially was just an amazingly dynamic city because it was the new capital of this newly unified Germany only since 1871, and it was also expanding just with incredible speed. So the population doubled about every 10 or 15 years over the course of maybe 40 years. And so in, you know, this 15-20 year period leading up to the outbreak of the First World War, there was a lot going on. There was lots and lots of growth, but also along with that, a lot of dislocation. There was this huge new German working class that was growing in Berlin. There was amazing industry. Berlin in this period was sometimes described as the Silicon Valley of, you know, the late 19th, early 20th century. So there was just a great deal of economic dynamism. But I think what this created also was a certain sort of anonymity, which made it possible for people to experiment in ways maybe that they wouldn't have been able to do in either a smaller city or maybe another European capital that was more established or that wasn't as dynamic or growing as rapidly.
It was a pretty decadent town, though, really.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. For one thing, I think there wasn't the same sort of established church that you would have found in either Paris or London. There was no equivalent of the Church of England exactly. There was no Catholic Church. And I think that also created a certain sense of tolerance and toleration. There's one other really important factor here, and that is the kinds of policies that were developed by the Berlin police specifically. And fairly early on, already in the 1880s, they decided that as a pragmatic issue, it wasn't really a good idea to try to prevent different sorts of bars or cafes from appealing to or catering to what appeared to be a homosexual or in some cases a lesbian public. And so these kinds of establishments were actually allowed to operate fairly openly, where people could congregate without fear of some kind of arrest or a raid. And this was also something I think that Berlin was probably unique for, at least compared to a lot of other places in Europe at this point.
Hi, this is François Sagat.
Et vous écoutez Joy sur 94.9.
This is Douglas.
And this is Paula.
From Kaleidoscope Australia Human Rights Foundation, keeping a watchful eye on LGBTI rights across Asia and the Pacific.
On the World Wide Wave.
Tonight we are talking to Robert Beachy. Robert described the city of Berlin, buoyed by economic growth in the early 20th century, as a place of anonymity, tolerance and acceptance by authorities of its gay scene. We asked Robert if it was the social openness that attracted some of the LGBT thinkers of their day to Berlin.
I think it played a role. If you mean by LGBT thinkers, I assume you're talking about probably different psychiatrists and maybe sexologists.
Yes.
Medical doctors, people who were sort of theorizing about this identity and in some cases trying to conduct even ethnographic studies of this emerging community, I think some were actually attracted to Berlin specifically for this reason, but some of them were already there. And this is also maybe another partial explanation for why Berlin. It had a lot to do with the social sciences and the human sciences in Germany in the second half of the 19th century. So the Germans, in a lot of ways, pioneered a lot of these early social and human sciences, psychiatry, psychology, sociology. And Berlin also had a really prominent and what some consider to be the first real research university, the University of Berlin, which wasn't an old school. It was only established in 1810, but it was really established with the idea that the university should do more than just train professionals, doctors, lawyers, but should also be a place where new knowledge was created or discovered. This also was a principle that was applied then to the study of society, the study of individuals. And so I think this was also a real impulse for looking at what seemed to be a new and different kind of sexual identity, a new sexual minority.
One of those new thinkers was Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, and he is presented as the first person to really say that same-sex desire was biological.
That's right. That's probably almost an overstatement. I think there have probably been people for a long time who have maybe believed that, but he really tried to develop a hard and fast theory, and it also motivated his homosexual rights activism. So he also helped to found really what's the world's first homosexual rights movement or organization in Berlin in 1897. And he really also believed that this was the very best way to gain larger sort of public acceptance and ultimately reform and change the law. I should maybe mention it was also based in part on his own experience as a German Jew. These were people who were simply born a different way, but they were a legitimate minority within this larger group. And homosexuals, in some ways, I think Hirschfeld believed, were really just like Jews. They just needed to be understood and accepted.
This sort of research into sex and sexuality, was that fairly radical for its time?
It was fairly radical in a lot of respects. I think a lot of people were very nervous or anxious about the idea of exploring these, I guess, facets of human behavior, human existence. But on the other hand, I think there was a certain openness that came from this respect for science. So it was possible to do lots of kinds of research and write scientific works, make different sorts of claims and arguments when it was couched in scientific terms for the sake of actually expanding human knowledge about some specific subject.
And that included transsexuality, which really didn't have a whole lot of profile or a whole lot of science behind it up until that stage. What made transsexuality a topic of interest during this time?
Well, here I think Magnus Hirschfeld really has to be given most of the credit, and it came out of his own familiarity with a large community of people he called transvestites, and he actually coined that word and used it for the first time in a publication in 1910. You know, his initial insight was there are these people who seem to have this compulsion or, you know, really, really feel like they need to wear the clothing of a man as a woman or vice versa. And they also want to present in public. They want to be able to go out on the street or go to bars, you know, dressed in the clothing of the opposite sex. And what he figured out, I think, just based on his familiarity with so many individuals, I mean, he claimed to know thousands and thousands within the city of Berlin, what he figured out was that a lot of these people didn't have any genuine same-sex desire. So it wasn't about sexual orientation per se. It was something unrelated to that almost. And later, during the First World War and then just after the First World War, he also was then involved in what became the first primitive sexual reassignment surgeries. So people would actually undergo surgery to remove or change their genitalia or to have radical mastectomies, sometimes hysterectomies. And his Institute for Sexual Science that he established after the war in late 1918 was one of the sites where some of these early, very, very primitive, often very unsuccessful surgeries were being performed. But what he really ended up theorizing was that this is something different from sexual orientation. And so he used some language. He didn't really come up with sort of the modern concept of transgender identity, but he hinted at it, and I think he was the very first to really appreciate this strong difference, this sort of theoretical distinction between orientation and gender identity. He simply saw enough people that he was no longer willing to just generalize the way so many had done for so long and assume that cross-dressing was somehow a manifestation of homosexuality. And in that respect, I think it was especially brilliant.
Joy 94.9.
That was Robert Beachy, author of the book Gay Berlin, Birthplace of Modern Identity, explaining how 1920s Berlin fostered the first thoughts of distinction between sexual orientation and gender identity, which I didn't know prior to looking into this. I mean, we sort of, I guess we take it for granted a bit these days that that is the case. And I don't know about you guys, but I was probably thinking things would have been pretty bad back then.
Well, no, I didn't. I wouldn't have thought about where it all came from.
Yeah.
You don't think about where it all started.
I sort of knew about the party scene. I knew about the cabaret and the drag and that intense nightlife aspect of Berlin at the time. But I had no concept that there were all these people thinking and theorising, academics looking into homosexuality from a scientific viewpoint. And I love that bit that he says that there was a respect for science. Therefore, when you started talking about homosexuality in a scientific term, people sort of turned their heads and, oh, okay, that's good. That just
isn't that interesting? I mean, to have it approached from such a different angle to, I guess, what the way that we see it, or we as in Australia at least, or in the Western cultures, how we see it approached. And it's, yeah, completely different. It's more a cultural thing, but it's definitely not really examined from a scientific point of view so much.
It does raise the question, though, if they were talking about it back then, why has it taken so long for it to be...
Yeah, what's going on?
You know, why has it taken so long for it to be removed as a mental illness?
Yeah, look, I'm sure the Nazi regime played a big part of that, both in, you know, exterminating great numbers of people. And, you know, they're all the target groups. Scientific people, right, get rid of them. Gays, get rid of them. Jews, get rid of them. I think there was a great loss of knowledge and just a fear. People wouldn't come out and...
Well, there was the great book burning. You know, any knowledge that wasn't deemed correct was destroyed.
I also was surprised in that this was sort of the first time that they looked at sexual identity, the coining of the term transvestite, and that they changed the thought process from people who, I guess, dressed up in drag, gay guys who performed but wore women clothes, and came up with that distinction to people who actually lived or wanted to live their life as another gender.
And he makes the point that they made the distinction between the sexuality that they and their identity, that it wasn't a sexual identity, that these people wanted to appear in public as the other sex. It wasn't necessarily that they were attracted to the other sex.
And how far have we come this week? Online, I found a news story. A travel company in Germany has launched a cruise especially for trans travellers. The cruise is going from Germany to Hungary, 7-night cruise, you know, going to all the nice places along the way, Vienna, Bratislava, Slovakia. And basically, they've come up with this need, saying that they understand that members of the trans community face additional challenges when they travel, and this gives them an opportunity to have a holiday in perfect security and with a very understanding hosts, I guess.
Well, probably should set the scene where Germany is at the moment. I mean, equal age of consent was in 1994. They've got recognition of same-sex couples, although they haven't got marriage. That was in 2001. And they've got anti-discrimination laws in employment, goods and services, 2006. And even in 2013, third gender on birth certificates.
And then just last month, the first trans model appeared on the cover of Men's Health in Germany, a female-to-male trans person.
Interestingly, though, I mean, if they started the conversation in the late 1800s, it took them till 1968, 1969 before they actually legalised same-sexual activity. So you've got to go be in it for the long haul.
But they still did it a bit quicker than here.
message in. Thanks, Melina. Melina also watched Q&A on Monday night and realised that human rights are a precious commodity to be traded in governments for commercial gain. I'm also proud to have a progressive leader in Mr. Andrews that protects minority groups from bullies. Great show. Thanks, Melina, for your comments.
Want to hear more? Find out about LGBT life in over 100 countries. Download free podcasts of this show. Subscribe to iTunes or follow us on Twitter. Visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
Hello, this is Wolfgang from Conchita Wurst City, which is Vienna in Austria. You're listening to Worldwide Wave from Joy 94.9.
A quick shout out, because we've got a couple of great shows coming up to tie it in with Melbourne Queer Film Festival. So this is the second largest film festival in Victoria and the longest running queer film festival in Australia.
Starting March 31st until April 11th.
128 films from 22 countries. We'll be covering a few of those.
38 features, 16 documentaries, 47 shorts, and 11 Australian premieres.
So the one that's coming up next week, we are talking with the directors of Mala Mala, which is a critically acclaimed and award-winning exploration of 9 trans-identifying people in Puerto Rico. And it is a fascinating insight. In fact, we had so much audio, we've got way too much. We've got to cut it all down.
Yes, it was due for today, but we just couldn't get around to it.
Now, so the best way to keep up to date with these shows is to tune into Outtakes, which is on Mondays at 7 here on Joy 94.9, our very own queer cinema program, and book your tickets online at mqff.com.au.
A little less straight than other radio stations. Joy 94.9.
We've been speaking tonight about Gay Berlin in the late 1800s and early 1900s. One story from Robert Beachy's book, our guest, involved one of the German emperor's closest friends being charged with homosexual acts. While he wasn't convicted of having homosexual acts, he was found guilty of having perjured himself in a libel suit where he denied his homosexuality. We asked Robert to explain the story and its significance.
Oh, yeah, that's an amazing story, and it has so many twists and turns. It's actually kind of complicated. But in short, there was a kind of political opponent, a kind of independent journalist who had his own small weekly journal that he published and wrote pretty much all by himself. His name was Maximilian Hardenberg. And he knew that one of the Kaiser's very closest friends was almost certainly homosexual. The man, Eulenburg, was married and had children. But this journalist saw this as an opportunity to take him down, pretty much by outing him. And so he started publishing stories, or he would make innuendos in some of his articles. Once the Kaiser found out that these implications were being published, he forced his best friend to either challenge him to a duel or sue him for libel or do something about it. And this led to a whole series of trials that dragged on for about 3 years. Eventually, the man charged with being homosexual, Eulenburg, the Kaiser's very good friend, he was never brought to trial successfully and found guilty of violating the anti-homosexual or anti-sodomy clause. But he was alienated from the Kaiser's court and the Kaiser's circle, which was really the journalist's ultimate goal. The bigger issue, at least from my perspective, is the way that it disclosed, it showed how this new category of homosexuality sort of made it impossible for people who were maybe married but still had different kinds of same-sex affairs or attractions, how they were forced in certain ways to adopt this new identity that was being sort of formulated. And then I guess the second point was there was so much press, there was so much attention paid to the scandal starting in about 1907. It really, in a certain way, put Berlin on the map as a scene or center of homosexuality even before 1914. This is really, really significant, this kind of publicity, for good or ill.
As a scholar, for you personally, what's the attraction of this period of Gay Berlin?
My initial attraction was just discovering how much was, in fact, going on, what kinds of debates they were having already. I mean, they were discussing whether or not they should conduct active outing campaigns and out, you know, people that had public profiles but who were living double lives. I mean, you know, that sounds like something from the 1990s, but that was going on already, you know, at the very beginning of the 20th century, almost a century earlier. And then I guess I am a German historian by training. That's how I got my start, and that's what I've focused on for most of my career, professional life. And it's so counterintuitive for so many people to hear something that might be described as positive or progressive going on in a place like Berlin already before 1914, before the First World War. It's counterintuitive. And so that makes it, I guess, that much more fun for me, too. It's not what you expect from Prussia.
Robert Beachy, author of the book Gay Berlin, Birthplace of a Modern Identity. Thanks for joining us on World Wide Wave.
Oh, it's been great to talk to you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
So Robert Beachy there, Gay Berlin, Birthplace of a Modern Identity is the book. Interestingly, we were talking about the modern day same-sex marriage.
It seems to have stalled a bit in Germany, doesn't
it? Yeah, because Angela Merkel is against it.
Well, they got civil partnerships in 2001, but it hasn't moved much since then.
And there was a survey out just last year. 68% of Germans support granting same-sex couples equal marriage. Only 24% are absolutely opposed. And that figure's pretty good. But then when you look at Angela Merkel's own party, 61% who say they voted for her support marriage equality. So this would be another case of a leader not supporting what the public wants.
The parallels are incredible.
Messages coming in, loving them. Pamela, thank you very much. What an insightful show. Well done. There has always been elements of fascism amongst gay men. Greece's Golden Dawn has gay members as well. Thanks for that, Pamela. Very interesting. Message in about Eurovision. Art says just India and China. That's over 500 million viewers in each. So a potential audience of 1 billion people tuning in. Wow, that's a lot.
I think that's slightly more than the 200 that watch Eurovision.
at 4 a.m. in the morning. And Christine on the Botswana's High Court ruling, Lega Bibo are an amazing organisation. Such a long journey to this win. Thanks, Christine. Thank you all for the messages.
Receive LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like World Wide Wave on Facebook now.
This is Tiseke Kasambalas from Human Rights Watch, South Africa office on the World Wide Wave.
What an interesting and inspiring show. A big thank you to our guest tonight, Robert Beachy, author of the book Gay Berlin, Birthplace of a Modern Identity. You can find that at the bookshop in Sydney, Hares and Hyenas in Melbourne, or online at your favourite bookstore.
We would love to thank everyone that interacted with us on Facebook. That's Scott, Greg and Martina. And there's a heap more.
Queen Emily, I had to say that one. Thank you, Queen Emily.
That's W3Joy on Facebook.
In fact, just as you were speaking, because we just posted a photo of you two guys in the studio having lots of fun, Kisa and Scott have both liked the photo there.
Well, thank you. And we would like to thank everyone that sent in an SMS or email. And, of course, Gordon on the front desk for manning the phone so manly.
Thank you, Gordon. Coming up next week, as we mentioned, Melbourne Queer Film Festival show. We are looking at Mala Mala, a story of trans people in Puerto Rico. Catch you next week on World Wide Wave.
Thank you for listening to the World Wide Wave podcast. We're always looking for interested guests and news tips. You can email us at worldwidewave@joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.